Chapter 35. The Scots craze. But when the pathetic circumstances of the sergeant major's end became known in the town, the officers of the Greys offered the services of their fine reed and brass band, that he might have a funeral marked by due military honors. His body was accordingly removed to the barracks, and carried thence to the churchyard in the Durnover quarter on the following afternoon. One of the Grey's most ancient and docile chargers being blacked up to represent Clark's horse on the occasion. Everybody pitied Selina, whose story was well known. She followed the corpse as the only mourner, Clark having been without relations in this part of the country, and a communication with his regiment having brought none from a distance. She sat in a little shabby brown-black mourning carriage, squeezing herself up in a corner, to be as much as possible out of sight during the slow and dramatic march through the town to the tune from Saul. When the interment had taken place, the volleys been fired, and the return journey begun, it was with something like a shock that she found the military escort to be moving at a quick march to the lively strains of Off She Goes. ... as if all care for the sergeant major was expected to be ended with the late discharge of the carbines. It was, by chance, the very tune to which they had been footing when he died, and unable to bear its notes, as he hastily told her driver to drop behind. The band and military party diminished up the high street, and Selina turned over Swan Bridge and homeward to Mellstock. Then recommenced for her a life whose incidents were precisely of a suit with those which had preceded the soldier's return, but how different in her appreciation of them. Her narrow miss of the recovered respectability they had hoped for from that tardy event worked upon her parents as an irritant, and after the first week or two of her mourning, her life with them grew almost insupportable. As he had impulsively taken to herself the weeds of a widow, for such she seemed to herself to be, and clothed little Johnny in sables likewise. This assumption of a moral relationship to the deceased, which he asserted to be only not a legal one by two most unexpected accidents, led the old people to indulge in sarcasm at her expense whenever they beheld her attire, though all the while it cost them more pain to utter than it gave her to hear it. Having become accustomed by her residence at home to the business carried on by her father, she surprised them one day by going off with the child to Chalk Newton, in the direction of the town of Ivel, and opening a miniature fruit and vegetable shop, attending Ivel Market with her produce. Her business grew somewhat larger, and it was soon sufficient to enable her to support herself and the boy in comfort. She called herself Mrs. John Clark from the day of leaving home, and painted the name on her signboard, no man forbidding her. By degrees the pain of her state was forgotten in her new circumstances, and getting to be generally accepted as the widow of a sergeant major of dragoons, an assumption which her modest and mournful demeanor seemed to substantiate, her life became a placid one, her mind being nourished by the melancholy luxury of dreaming what might have been her future in New Zealand with John, if he had only lived to take her there. Her only travels now were a journey to Ivel on market days, and once a fortnight to the churchyard in which Clark lay, there to tend, with Johnny's assistance, as widows are wont to do, the flowers as he had planted upon his grave. On a day about 18 months after his unexpected decease, Selina was surprised in her lodging over her little shop by a visit from Bartholomew Miller. He had called on her once or twice before, on which occasions he had used without a word of comment the name by which she was known. "I've come this time," he said, "less because I was in this direction than to ask you, Mrs. Clark, what you mid well guess. I've come o' purpose, in short." She smiled. "'Tis to ask me again to marry you?" "Yes, of course. You see, his coming back for ye proved what I always believed of ye, though others didn't. There's nobody but would be glad to welcome you to our parish again, now you've showed your independence and acted up to your trust in his promise. Well, my dear, will you come?" apostrophe apostrophe, I'd rather bide as Mrs. Clark, I think, apostrophe, she answered. I am not ashamed of my position at all, for I am John's widow in the eyes of heaven. Apostrophe apostrophe, I quite agree, that's why I've come. Still, you won't like to be always straining at this shopkeeping and market standing, and 'twould be better for Johnny if you had nothing to do but tend him. Apostrophe apostrophe, he here touched the only weak spot in Selina's resistance to his proposal, the good of the boy. To promote that there were other men she might have married offhand without loving them, if they had asked her to. But though as he had known the worthy speaker from her youth, she could not for the moment fancy herself happy as Mrs. Miller. He paused a while. I ought to tell ye, Mrs. Clark, apostrophe, he said by and by, that marrying is getting to be a pressing question with me. Not on my own account at all. The truth is, that mother is growing old, and I am away from home a good deal, so that it is almost necessary there should be another person in the house with her besides me. That's the practical consideration which forces me to think of taking a wife, apart from my wish to take you, and you know there's nobody in the world I care for so much. Apostrophe apostrophe, she said something about there being far better women than she, and other natural commonplaces, but assured him she was most grateful to him for feeling what he felt, as indeed she sincerely was. However, Selina would not consent to be the useful third person in his comfortable home at any rate just then. He went away, after taking tea with her, without discerning much hope for him in her goodbye. Why, after that evening she saw and heard nothing of him for a great while. Her fortnightly journeys to the Sergeant Major's grave were continued, whenever weather did not hinder them, and Mr. Miller must have known, she thought, of this custom of hers. But though the churchyard was not nearly so far from his homestead as was her shop at Chalk Newton, he never appeared in the accidental way that lovers use. An explanation was forthcoming in the shape of a letter from her mother, who casually mentioned that Mr. Bartholomew Miller had gone away to the other side of Shottsford Forum, to be married to a thriving dairyman's daughter that he knew there. His chief motive, it was reported, had been less one of love than a wish, to provide a companion for his aged mother. Selina was practical enough to know that as he had lost a good, and possibly the only opportunity of settling in life, after what had happened, and for a moment she regretted her independence. But she became calm on reflection, and to fortify herself in her course started that afternoon, to tend the Sergeant Major's grave, in which she took the same sober pleasure as at first. On reaching the churchyard and turning the corner towards the spot as usual, she was surprised to perceive another woman, also apparently a respectable widow, and with a tiny boy by her side, bending over Clark's turf, and sputting up with the point of her umbrella some ivy roots that Selina had reverently planted there to form an evergreen mantle over the mound. What are you digging up my ivy for? Apostrophe apostrophe, cried Selina, rushing forward so excitedly that Johnny tumbled over a grave with the force of the tug she gave his hand in her sudden start. Your ivy? Apostrophe apostrophe, said the respectable woman. Why yes. I planted it there on my husband's grave. Apostrophe, your husband's? Apostrophe apostrophe, yes. The late Sergeant Major Clark. Anyhow, as good as my husband, for he was just going to be. Apostrophe apostrophe, indeed. But who may be my husband, if not he? I am the only Mrs. John Clark, widow of the late Sergeant Major of Dragoons, and this is his only son and heir. Apostrophe apostrophe, how can that be? Apostrophe apostrophe, faltered Selina, her throat seeming to stick together as she just began to perceive its possibility. He had been going to marry me twice, and we were going to New Zealand. Apostrophe apostrophe, ah. I remember about you, apostrophe, returned the legitimate widow calmly and not unkindly. You must be Selina. He spoke of you now and then, and said that his relations with you would always be a weight on his conscience. Well, the history of my life with him is soon told. When he came back from the Crimea, he became acquainted with me at my home in the north, and we were married within a month of first knowing each other. Unfortunately, after living together a few months, we could not agree, and after a particularly sharp quarrel, in which, perhaps, I was most in the wrong, as I don't mind owning here by his graveside, he went away from me, declaring he would buy his discharge and emigrate to New Zealand, and never come back to me anymore. The next thing I heard was that he had died suddenly at Mellstock at some low carouse, and as he had left me in such anger, to live no more with me, I wouldn't come down to his funeral, or do anything in relation to him. 'Twas temper, I know, but that was the fact. Even if we had parted friends, it would have been a serious expense to travel 300 miles to get there, for one who wasn't left so very well off. I am sorry I pulled up your ivy roots, but that common sort of ivy is considered a weed in my part of the country. December 1899. Atristed an ancient earthwork. At one's every step forward it rises higher against the south sky, with an obtrusive personality that compels the senses to regard it and consider. The eyes may bend in another direction, but never without the consciousness of its heavy, high-shouldered presence at its point of vantage. Across the intervening levels the gale races in a straight line from the fort, as if breathed out of it hitherward. With the shifting of the clouds the faces of the steeps vary in color and in shade, broad lights appearing where mist and vagueness had prevailed, dissolving in their turn into melancholy gray, which spreads over and eclipses the luminous bluffs. In this so thought immutable spectacle all is change. Out of the invisible marine region on the other side birds soar suddenly into the air, and hang over the summits of the heights with the indifference of long familiarity. Their forms are white against the tawny concave of cloud, and the curves they exhibit in their floating signify that they are seagulls which have journeyed inland from expected stress of weather. As the birds rise behind the fort, so do the clouds rise behind the birds, almost as it seems, stroking with their bagging bosoms the uppermost flyers. The profile of the whole stupendous ruin, as seen at a distance of a mile eastward, is cleanly cut as that of a marble inlay. It is varied with protuberances, which from hereabouts have the animal aspect of warts, wens, knuckles, and hips. It may indeed be likened to an enormous many-limbed organism of an antediluvian time partaking of the cephalopod in shape, lying lifeless, and covered with a thin green cloth, which hides its substance, while revealing its contour. This dull green mantle of herbage stretches down towards the levels, where the plows have essayed for centuries to creep up near, and yet nearer to the base of the castle, but have always stopped short before reaching it. The furrows of these environing attempts show themselves distinctly, bending to the incline as they trench upon it, mounting in steeper curves, till the steepness baffles them, and their parallel threads show like the stree of waves pausing on the curl. The peculiar place of which these are some of the features is Mai Dun, the castle of the great hill, said to be the Dunium of Ptolemy, the capital of the Durotriges, which eventually came into Roman occupation, and was finally deserted on their withdrawal from the island. The evening is followed by a night on which an invisible moon bestows a subdued, yet pervasive light without radiance, as without blackness. From the spot whereon I am ensconced in a cottage, a mile away, the fort has now ceased to be visible, yet, as by day, to anybody whose thoughts have been engaged with it, and its barbarous grandeurs of past time, the form asserts its existence behind the night gauzes as persistently as if it had a voice. Moreover, the southwest wind continues to feed the intervening arable flats with vapors brought directly from its sides. The midnight hour for which there has been occasion to wait at length arrives, and I journey towards the stronghold in obedience to a request urged earlier in the day. It concerns an appointment, which I rather regret my decision to keep now that night has come. The route thither is hedgeless and treeless, I need not add deserted. The moonlight is sufficient to disclose the pale ribbon-like surface of the way as it trails along between the expanses of darker fallow. Though the road passes near the fortress, it does not conduct directly to its fronts. As the place is without an inhabitant, so it is without a trackway. So presently leaving the macadamized road, to pursue its course elsewhither, I step off upon the fallow, and plod stumblingly across it. The castle looms out of the shade by degrees, like a thing waking up and asking what I want there. It is now so enlarged by nearness, that its whole shape cannot be taken in at one view. The plowed ground ends as the rise sharpens, the sloping basement of grass begins, and I climb upward, to invade Ma'idun. Impressive by day as this largest ancient British work in the kingdom undoubtedly is, its impressiveness is increased now. After standing still, and spending a few minutes in adding its age to its size, and its size to its solitude, it becomes appallingly mournful in its growing closeness. A squally wind blows in the face with an impact which proclaims that the vapors of the air sail low tonight. The slope that I so laboriously clamber up the wind skips sportively down. Its track can be discerned even in this light by the undulations of the withered grass bents, the only produce of this upland summit except moss. 4 minutes of ascent, and a vantage ground of some sort is gained. It is only the crest of the outer rampart. Immediately within this a chasm gapes. Its bottom is imperceptible, but the counterscarp slopes not too steeply, to admit of a sliding descent if cautiously performed. The shady bottom, dank and chilly, is thus gained, and reveals itself as a kind of winding lane, wide enough for a wagon to pass along, floored with rank herbage, and trending away, right and left, into obscurity, between the concentric walls of earth. The towering closeness of these on each hand, their impenetrability, and their ponderousness, are felt as a physical pressure. The way is now up the second of them, which stands steeper and higher than the first. To turn aside, as did Christian's companion, from such a hill difficulty, is the more natural tendency, but the way to the interior is upward. There is, of course, an entrance to the fortress, but that lies far off on the other side. It might possibly have been the wiser course, to seek for easier ingress there. However, being here, I ascend the second acclivity. The grass stems the gray beard of the hill sway in a mass close to my stooping face. The dead heads of these various grasses fescues, foxtails, and rise bob and twitch, as if pulled by a string underground. From a few thistles a whistling proceeds. And even the moss speaks, in its humble way, under the stress of the blast. That the summit of the second line of defense has been gained is suddenly made known by a contrasting wind from a new quarter, coming over with the curve of a cascade. These novel gusts raise a sound. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.